I would say that our practice is basically about examining our experience more and more closely, studying mind and body now and now and each moment, becoming more intimate with ourselves and therefore with each other also. Getting to know who we are and how we experience the world. So studying ourselves and studying our relationships with each other and the world. In order to have our experience flow more freely, to find ease and bring ease to others. So in old India, they had Buddhist universities, like you might have heard of Nalanda University, went on for many, many centuries after the Buddha's time in India. The ruins still remain, not far from Bodh Gaya. Maybe the first type of university model in the world. I'm not sure about that. It was, you know, I think maybe after the time of Christ, but around that time when it started. And they, in the Indian Buddhist learning, they sometimes looked at the curriculum of kind of five areas of study. First one being the creative arts. These are like the kind of five sciences or five areas of study in old Indian learning. Creative arts are like, you know, painting and sculpture, actually. And what we think of as arts today, as well as maybe also making other things, but like practical crafts and using mind and body and bringing them together to help produce things and relate to others through art. So, and there was, as we know, lots of Buddhist art from way, way back. And, you know, when I think about these five sciences, Buddhist sciences of study, I think, oh, well, nice to keep them all in mind at our little Zen center here. And the first one being creative arts, I had thought, how great, we have Zen in the arts program. With a lot of energy from Sally and Chuck to really create this as a particular program. And using mind and body to create physical things in the world. Second, science is healing and medicine. You might think, well, what do these have to do with Buddhism? But actually, they, you know, maybe when the Buddha was alive, these weren't emphasized so much, but as it became a whole field of learning, these were included, just like they would be in a modern university. Healing and medicine, related to, and in this case, physical, maybe herbs and healing techniques, and but also mind and the way that physical and mental work together to create a healthy body and spirit and mind. So again, here at Zen Center, we have had like a medical Qigong, at least Qigong classes. What's it called? Medical Qigong? For emotional healing. So I think that's maybe fits into this category. We do a little of such practice, not directly Zen maybe, but helpful to the whole being of a person. Yeah? The third science or study is language and grammar. And we maybe don't do so much of that here, but just as any school people in the old days, maybe they didn't learn language and grammar in grammar school. They didn't maybe have grammar school, so just the older people at the university maybe learned to read and write. And as a way to convey information and study the Buddha's teachings, you have to know how to read and write. Here, maybe people might study other languages to learn Buddhist teachings and so on, for communication. And so these first three are maybe don't seem directly coming out of Shakyamuni Buddha's teaching, but as help or support for the project of liberation of all beings. The fourth science is logic, or also how we know things. And this is what I wanted to speak about tonight, because we speak about it a little bit, more about how we know things and how perception works. I wanted to speak about the fifth science is like inner science, or like meditation and philosophy. And that's maybe the main thing we think of as teaching in the Buddhist and Zen realm. We could even say like Zen stories are the Zen version of philosophy. They bring out the teachings and the instructions on meditation practice, of course, is maybe the main thing we emphasize here. So creative arts, healing and medicine, language and grammar, logic and how we know things, the science of what we can call valid cognition, and then these inner sciences of meditation and philosophy. So I just think that's kind of interesting that in the old days in India, they had a very well-rounded education, and that we include a lot of those things still. So this fourth topic of how we know things, and maybe kind of a forerunner to studying philosophy and how things are in reality, is first we have to, before we get fully into how things are, how things exist or don't exist, we have to understand how perception and conception works, how we know things. The science of valid cognition. In Sanskrit, pramana. Valid cognition, the definition of valid cognition is an awareness, or a cognition, a consciousness, a mind, that's new, fresh, in the moment. To be valid cognition, In terms of these definitions, it's not like some past, memory of something. We're talking about the a present moment experience. To directly know something is always new, fresh in the moment, and it's undeceiving. That's what valid means. It's not deceptive. It's like if we just have like various types of non-valid cognition, deceiving awarenesses would be like an awareness or a conceptual thought, a conceptual mind that thinks this body is totally permanent, for example. That is a cognition. It's a thought, but it's not valid in this sense because it's not true. It's a false thing. So we maybe actually have many, many non-valid cognitions all day long. And another one would be like doubt, or an awareness that's divided between alternative possibilities, or just like not completely clear. I think that it's gonna rain tonight. It might rain. It kind of feels like rain a little bit. So I think it's gonna rain. Yeah, it's gonna rain. It'll be like a non-valid cognition because it's not really based on any flawless logic or reason, even though there may be a lot of things to support that idea. So those are examples of non-valid cognition, but to speak about valid cognition, it's a new, undeceiving awareness. And there's, within valid cognition, there's direct and indirect. This is kind of how these, Indians sometimes thought, it's like a subsets of subsets, right? So you might have to pay attention to follow this. But for me, this is really quite interesting, the way they structure experience. Within indirect, basically indirect valid, you can have a valid cognition indirectly as a conceptual thought that's actually accurate. For example, maybe like this body is impermanent. It's actually ceasing every moment. It never stays the same for more than a second. And so it's a conceptual understanding. And if it's in accord with reason and logic, and we can kind of prove that it's so, then it could be a indirect valid cognition. And in the realm of direct valid cognition, direct means non-conceptual. Indirect means conceptual. Direct means non-conceptual, new, fresh, undeceiving mind moment. Yeah. Non-conceptual and non-mistaken awareness. So one example that's sometimes given for, you could have a non-conceptual but mistaken cognition that wouldn't be valid. Can you imagine a non-conceptual but mistaken? One example is like, at night if you take a incense stick or something and you circle it around in the air and you see a circle. And so it's not a conceptual thing. Your sensory apparatus, your visual consciousness is actually perceiving a circle in the air, but it's not really a circle. It's just because it's moving so quickly and our the way our visual consciousness works is it can't follow that line so quickly. It blurs it into a circle. We're kind of limited by the speed of our sensory functions. So it's not conceptual, but the actual seeing it as a circle of light is actually not technically accurate. You might say, well, it really does appear that way, but we're talking about, we're like zooming in on exactly how we truly experience things. So does that make sense? It's a non-conceptual cognition, but it's not valid because it's a mistaken perception. Or maybe a mirage could be another one. Like you really, in the distance you see, in the shimmering heat waves on the desert, you see the water there. And your senses are actually, you're not confusing the concept, you really see it as water. It's like a hallucination. So it's not conceptual. I mean, if you start labeling it as water, then it becomes conceptual. But just seeing the image of shininess on the desert sand would be like, it's still, you're actually seeing it non-conceptually, but it's not accurate. to reality.
You are on direct, is that right?
That's direct, yeah. So it's a direct, non-valid cognition. So you can have direct valid when actually part of valid means the awareness is in accord with the characteristics of the object. So since the object is actually just sand, the awareness is not in accord with the characteristics of sand. It looks like water. So we could have direct valid, we could have direct invalid, we could also have indirect valid, which would be like a correct concept, right? And we could have indirect invalid, which would be like a conceptual thought that's not true. And in fact, I think the proposal is here that most of our kind of like thought activity throughout the day is non-valid, indirect conception. I say on most of our conceptual experience, because at the same time, continuously we're having actually direct, valid cognitions of colors and sounds and stuff all the time also. So happening at the same time. So now to go further into the labyrinth of direct valid cognition. So remember now, direct means like it's non-conceptual, it's fresh and new, and valid means it's non-deceptive in terms of the object of awareness. So there's four types of direct valid cognition. We're kind of zooming in on like our very basic workings of perception, of mind perception, and how we know the world in a direct, very direct way. So I think this is quite interesting. The first one is called sensory direct valid cognition. We have five senses, and they directly cognize five sense objects, our five faculties: eye, ear, nose, tongue, body. Meat, color, sound, smells, tastes, and tangible objects. And where the sense faculty and the sense field or object meet, the sense consciousness arises and perceives that visual, auditory, olfactory, gustatory, tactile experience. And all of these direct valid cognitions are dependently co-arising experiences. Maybe everyone's heard about interdependent arising of our world and our experience. And means it's dependent on certain conditions, and the dominant condition, sometimes different types of conditions, many conditions are needed for us to experience the color white. But the dominant condition is the sense faculty, so the eye organ, and looking into the visual experience a little bit more here, like the eye faculty is like this is just a report of that old Indian system that hasn't really changed, because people, I think they were studying their own experience very closely, and so it's pretty good what they came up with. But we might find modern science might contradict some of these things, which I think is a very interesting study to look at. Anyway, in this sense that we call the eye faculty like a subtle physicality. So maybe like the retina on the back of the eye, subtle receptivity. Physical, but we're not talking about the eyeball, that big round thing in the socket. That's not the eye faculty. It's what actually directly receives the color. So maybe we'd say retina in modern times. And one metaphor for this would be like a camera lens The camera lens is just aimed at the object, but the lens itself doesn't actually know the object. It's just the receiver, and kind of like it's what draws in and focuses the image. And then the object being the color, and then the film in the camera is kind of like the eye consciousness, where it actually, when the image meets the film, it's channeled through the faculty of the eye, and when it's registered on the film, that's like the eye consciousness, or the visual consciousness actually registers it as an image. It kind of transfers the color to the film. And so it's a mental thing. So I don't think we would say the image on the retina, actually, if we're talking about actually how our perception works. It's a mental image, but it's a mind created image of a direct sensory experience, just color, before any conceptual naming or anything like that. So this is sensory, direct, valid cognition. If we're colorblind, for example, that could be argued to be, it's a sensory cognition, but it's not valid. We're seeing in black and white. We're not seeing the actual color of the object. It's deceptive. So we're having sensory, direct, valid cognitions. All our waking seconds of the day. When we're asleep, we're not having, our senses are pretty much shut down. So dream images are not sensory. They're not coming through the five senses, they're mental. So the next of these four, direct valid cognitions, non-conceptual valid, is called mental direct valid cognition. And this is a tricky one because we're talking about a non-conceptual mental moment. So in this system, this is what those meditators in the meditation lab came up with to classify how this works, is that it's the moment after a sensory experience. Every moment we're having a sensory experience, but the next moment, which is a tiny, tiny little bit of time, the mental direct valid cognition only lasts for one moment. And it said it can't be recognized. It's not like you see the color, you just register the color as a sensory thing, and then the mental one, you can kind of get a hold of it. Anything you could get a hold of is a conceptual thing. And it said that, at least some people would say, some adept yogis could maybe catch that one moment of what we call mental direct valid cognition, but it's just a flash. And we could say, what's the purpose of even naming it, talking about it? One thing is it makes a link between the sensory experience and a conceptual experience. So we have sensory thing of white color, and now I know it's a white color. Before I even say it out loud, there's a conceptual idea of white, which is an extra step. And that's not what we mean by mental direct valid cognition, because that's an indirect cognition. This direct non-conceptual one makes a link between the sensory, direct sensory experience and the conceptual idea of white. Kind of links them. It's part of why they came up with it, seems like. The dominant condition for that is the previous moment, the previous sensory experience, because you need this particular mental direct valid cognition is always connected with a sense experience. So it's nothing to do with thoughts or even a mind, just awareness that's non-conceptual. It's, this particular one is always connected with sensory experience. It's like it's the moment following a sensory experience. The next one I'll list is called yogic direct valid cognition. So remember, direct means it's non-conceptual. Fresh, new, accurate experience. So yogic would be a very rare occurrence. Even the other two are happening all the time, whether we know it or not. But this one is a particular, it's what we call like a direct non-conceptual realization of no self or emptiness, which usually comes after quite a bit of work with indirect inferential valid cognitions, reasoning, kind of flawless reasoning to conclude that actually, though this body and mind are constantly changing, there's no, you know, permanent independent entity called a self behind that. I've heard this kind of thing. And all the teachings about emptiness in the Heart Sutra and so on. It would be like coming to an inferential valid cognition that really is true. And it's also, I think it's interesting just to, on this aside about the inferential here, that if you just say, okay, well, body and mind are constantly changing and I can't see anything besides that, so then there's no self. And you, in a way, the reasoning is accurate, is true. And we've maybe heard it many times when we've gone through the reasoning, but for it to be this fresh, undeceiving, new moment called valid cognition, it needs to kind of hit us like a hammer. It's like that's what makes it fresh and new. It's not like, yeah, I've heard it before, there's no self, I got it. It's like when the first moment of, oh wow, all that teaching I've heard all along, I really see it now, like conceptually, but the logic is like you get to the end of the logic and it's like, wow, I really see how what the Buddha keeps pointing to with this teaching. Still, it's conceptual, but it has an impact, a strong impact. And then due to that, and then deep settledness of meditation, then there can be this yogic direct valid cognition that's true. Basically, without any conceptual mediation about the reasoning anymore. Now it's like based on the reasoning, being convinced through reasoning that all dharmas are marked by emptiness. Now it's like without the concept behind it, it's like seeing it directly. And at a particular fresh new moment. And then anytime that one's meditating after that and perceives it again freshly in samadhi, basically. This is always happens in samadhi, which is this one-pointedness of mind. Then that's a new yogic direct valid cognition. So the dominant condition, instead of the dominant condition being the sensory, that the eye organ, or the previous moment of sense consciousness. In this case, the dominant condition for yogic direct valid cognition is the union of calm abiding and insight. So this one is now really directly dharmic practice oriented. The first two are just happening to everybody all the time, but this one comes through this particular practice of settling the mind in a very relaxed, open, spacious way in the present, and then in that present, spacious openness, directly seeing that things don't exist the way we think they do. That union is the primary condition for a fresh, new, yogic, direct valid cognition. So that's three. Sensory, mental, which is this little moment that comes right after a sensory one that helps create the platform for concepts, and then yogic. The fourth and final type of direct valid cognition is called self-aware direct valid cognition. And this one, I think, is maybe most interesting, so I save it for last. It's that, and there's some argument within the Buddhist tradition whether this whether this is valid or not. But those who say it's valid, particularly the people who came, who really brought forth and popularized this science of valid cognition, how we know things, are named Dignaga and Dharmakirti in old India. Dignaga is actually a direct student of Vasubandhu. So Vasubandhu is one of our Zen ancestors, so Dignaga's not on our list of ancestors, but he was probably good friends with the next ancestor and with Vasubandhu. So Vasubandhu, as you know, is very much connected with mind only and how the mind works. So the process kept evolving. And so his student said, well, let's really look at how we perceive things and know things. Anyway, Dignaga and Dharmakirti, those kind of founders of these pramana or valid cognition teachings, they both agree that there's this self-aware direct valid cognition, which is basically that the mind, it's a cognition that's aware of the of whatever mental activity is going on every moment. And it's automatic. Everybody has this one all the time. So three of these are operating for everybody all the time. The yogic one is kind of special for yogis. But this one, like the awareness that's aware of itself, actually. It's like the apprehender of the world, the apprehender apprehending the apprehender. The awareness being aware of awareness. And so sometimes it's said it's like a separate kind of cognition. So there's the I consciousness perceiving the color red here. There's the next moment of the mental direct valid cognition that kind of registers that. And then at the same time, at both of those moments, in every moment, there's this self-aware direct valid cognition that's just like aware of the experience. So by self-aware, it doesn't mean like I'm aware of myself. It means the experience is aware of itself. And remember, it's a direct valid cognition, so in a non-conceptual way. So if we say, oh, I can see how I'm aware of like everything that's happening here right now, that's a conceptually mediated version. So this one, we can't know it as its own experience, even though it's happening every moment. So part of the reason I bring this up tonight is because this self-aware, direct, valid cognition seems very similar to me to mirror awareness, our theme for the year. It's like there's There's experience of sensory activity, and they say this is with sensory activity and with concepts and thoughts and emotions. Every mental activity is conjoined with this self-aware, direct valid cognition at the same moment. Some people would say it like each moment is self-aware. Like there's having an experience of anger. There's a self-awareness of the anger that's kind of knowing the anger is happening and registering it. And some would say it's another cognition. There's the anger is one mind moment. At the same time, simultaneously with that experience of anger, there's a self-aware, direct, valid cognition that's non-conceptually just receiving the experience like a mirror. I think very similar. Sometimes they maybe even use that metaphor. It's an aspect of awareness, moment to moment, new moment, every moment, that just is aware of the experience that's happening, whether it's conceptual, non-conceptual, whatever. So in this early Indian tradition, we could hear this as if there is this self-aware, direct, valid cognition every moment, that we can open to that. We can't know it by definition. If we know it as something, that would make it an inferential, non-direct. Could be valid cognition, but it would be conceptual. But we can if it's the way that the mind is actually already operating, we can like settle into that more and more. We can rest in this self-aware, direct, valid cognition. And to understand this more and more and investigate our experience more and more to see how this could be the case, then it might be that very investigation and reasoning about this that could potentially lead to a yogic, direct, valid cognition of emptiness or non-duality. In a way, we could say it's a virtually non-dual awareness, that it's like awareness knowing itself. It's not knowing it, an external object. It's like the mind being aware of itself. And part of the reasoning for proposing this is it offers an explanation for how experiences, both sensory and conceptual, get registered in memory. It can be one of the ways of talking about how memory functions, because you can have a direct perception, a sensory direct valid cognition of like the taste of chocolate, right? You directly experience it, and then you can talk about, well, it's sweet like this, but it's hard to describe. It's a little bitter also, but you know the taste. And then you can, the next day, some might argue whether you actually are doing this, but it seems that, at least to some extent, the next day we can remember the actual taste of the chocolate, not just that it's sweet and bitter, but you can try to conjure up the memory, and you might not get it exactly, but there's a way in which we have a memory of that taste. And if your eyes are closed and you try to remember direct experience of red, beyond the label red, but the actual experience, direct sensory experience of red, you can do it, right? You know, we could talk about which type of cognition that is when we're closing our eyes, remembering red. But the fact that you can remember the actual sensory experience, some people would explain that by saying it's because there's the self-aware, direct, valid cognition actually registered the direct experience of red when it was happening, and now later that registry is still available, stored in the mind. So this might have been kind of a bit hard to follow and remember, and yeah, a lot more could be said about these other types, especially inferential valid cognition. So this was the focus on tonight, on direct valid cognition, the non-conceptual. How about just see if anyone remembers? What are the four types of direct valid cognition?
Indirect.
For direct valid cognitions.
Sensory.
Mental.
Yogic.
Self-aware. Yeah. And so sensory, the mental, which is this funny little thing connected with it, the bridge from sensory to conceptual, and self-aware, all three of those are happening every moment according to this theory. Every moment we're like awake and the senses are operating. And the yogic happens once in a blue moon. and then there's a bunch of indirect valid cognitions. Actually, it's maybe not a bunch. I would even say indirect valid cognition, if it's valid. I think that's maybe in a blue moon too. It means like it's a conceptual understanding that's totally accurate. I don't think that happens very much. It'd be like about impermanence or a conceptual understanding of no self. Or maybe a conceptual understanding of how perception works like this would count too. Okay, yes. Valid cognition, and there could be conceptual invalid cognitions also.
I would say either, but especially the direct one, I would argue can't exist. I would argue that the indirect valid conceptual can't exist, because the only way that it can be valid would be that you didn't just take it from somebody else's words.
Yes.
You've actually experienced it. It's no longer conception.
Well, that's a good question. But the tradition would say, this is where the logic part comes in. Through actual logical reasoning, and there's these, you know, if you get into the side of the indirect valid cognition, there's how proofs are set up, logical proofs. So just like a mathematical formula, right? You can say like 2 + 2 = 4, and somebody can tell you that, and you can memorize it. 2 + 2 = 4, and you know, you can. That's not a valid cognition. But if you actually understand the logic behind it, like you put two apples and two oranges, and you put them together, and you count four, and you keep doing that again and again. Little kids can do this with arithmetic, right? And you get the concept. So it's not just words on a paper. 2 + 2 really is 4. It's a conceptual idea, but you're totally convinced beyond the shadow of a doubt. You first heard it from some mathematician, but then you could prove it through logic. And then, so that would be the example. Would that work, do you think?
Well, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so with 2 + 2 = 4, could you see how you could have that? You could have an inferential, indirect, valid cognition through a proof, and be convinced, not just because somebody said, but because you know. Somebody says, actually, that was wrong, I made a mistake, 2 + 2 = 5. You'd say, like, you can't convince me. I know, it's so clear how it works here. Right? So you say, wow, I can't fool this person around this concept. They understand the concept so thoroughly that there's no doubt. Harder with Buddhist topics. But with 2 plus 2 is 4, at least could we see that one?
I wouldn't conceive it, no. But,
no?
Yeah.
What's missing?
The possibility that that's not true. I mean, unless you have a direct experience of that, but absolutely true.
But it is, right? If you see the two apples and the two oranges and you put them together.
It might be something that you don't see. I don't want to.
It's a great question. I know. I think it's a vital part of the conversation, I think, to see, like, what does that mean that you actually... you know nothing, you know. And we're talking about a limited, conceptual is always limited, right? So you say, well, maybe there's something about like invisible apples that are in here or something. And then you could say, but we're just talking, it's kind of basic thing. Where you're saying, well, if there's an invisible apple, then it would change. But if we're talking about visible apples and oranges, it's like, it seems in that case like it's simple enough that we can, according to that limited little model of math, you know, we could say, well, what about the fact that that this whole concept of math is just a conceptual construction? We could say that, for example, right?
That,
yeah, like that might be a Buddhist might start saying, well, the whole thing's made up, so no reasoning will work because all reasoning is just a strange mind thing, right? And so it's all, and then you'd say, in that case, what we're talking about in the realm of where logic does work. And if you go further into that thing of like, well, it's all conceptual constructs, so it all breaks down, then you're moving into the territory of the direct valid cognition, where it does all break down, actually. So in a way, you could say the inferential, maybe this is part of the point of that you're bringing up, the inferential direct valid cognitions will never be completely liberating. I think in the Buddhist thing, we need them because I think to get to the yogic direct valid cognition that's non-conceptual, the proposal, and this is somewhat debatable too, but the traditional proposal is that to realize emptiness, we have to know what we're actually talking about. They say, well, it just means like nothing really exists. It's like, I think the proposal is that won't really work. It's too, there's no logic behind it, you know. Because that's why there's the Prajnaparamita and Nagarjuna and these logicians who are like, first have this thing that there's like this actual insight, this aha in the conceptual mind. And I think in Buddhism, emptiness is, you know, maybe the hardest one to work with, but say like impermanence, well, maybe it's not, maybe not that hard to actually understand that all constructed things, all like, you know, physical phenomena are impermanent, even mountains. I think most of us maybe have actually come to that conclusion, that it's not that hard to get to have a conceptual maybe valid cognition of that, actually. I think we can have a pretty valid cognition of impermanence on a conceptual level, which is pretty great. And that actually changes us, right? That, I think, some people have never thought about impermanence before, but as practitioners, we've heard about it enough that maybe somebody dies, and it changes our experience of death a little bit. It's very painful when someone dies, but it's a little bit like we know that that's what's going to happen. Where somebody maybe hasn't really thought about it, like I get it now when it's happening, but like I really thought, like I haven't thought about this impermanence much, so it's really hitting me. It's so painful because I was. In the back of my mind, I was kind of expecting them to last forever. Yeah. So that's why we contemplate impermanence a lot, so that when we start noticing it, it's like, oh yeah, of course. Still very hard, but like, of course. I'm falling apart every moment and everything's falling apart. But that's the nature of the phenomenal world. So I think we could say, but what if there's some other factor in there that, like, maybe there's some phenomena that are permanent that we haven't found yet? So you could say that we might argue, well, so I maybe still have some doubt, and therefore that's when logic could come in. Everything I've seen so far is impermanent, but what if there was something? And then we try to find something and apply the logic to it. The logic is that everything arises according to conditions, and the conditions are constantly changing so that it can't last more than a second. And then we say, oh, okay, there it is. Yes?
Just a clarification, the self-awareness, you were kind of saying, like the mirror.
Yeah.
And then how does the storehouse consciousness fit into that term?
So yeah, in schools like Yogacara, that posits the storehouse consciousness, which not all Buddhism does, but they would say
that. Is that the same?
Well, it's more like the self-awareness is what's is the mechanism to register the experiences in the storehouse consciousness. It's like the worker.
Be more equal to a mirror? Or how does what's the mirror about?
Well, it's funny, yeah, because we can think, with our conceptual mind, we can think of it as, I was kind of thinking of it as like the storehouse is like a big container, and the self-aware thing is like the one that's kind of like pulling in the experiences. Or like we have the images of planting the seeds in the storehouse. That it's more like the mechanism that plants the seed would be like the self-aware, direct valid cognition, moment by every moment, planting a seed, which is our experience that then can later come to fruition tomorrow when we remember the taste of chocolate. So I was thinking of it a little separate, like the seed planter is like the self-aware, direct valid cognition, and the storehouse is like the field that the seeds are being planted in. But when you say it like, these are just conceptual images. It's not really like it's some bubble-like container, right? All of this is non-material. So if you say, is the self-aware direct valid cognition, is it actually the storehouse? I just had this little flash when you said that. I just reimagined it more like that. Instead of a seed planter, that is what we call the storehouse, is the mirror. Yeah, the mirror that's just receiving the images. It's just that this mirror is so ungraspable. Usually we've been talking about the mirror as it's just moment to moment reflex and then the thing's gone. That's how so far this year we've mostly been talking about mirror awareness. I think it's a nice way to practice with it. You know, there's red now, but now there's not, the red's gone completely. And until the red comes, the mirror is just will reflect blue or whatever else. But this would be another way to say, kind of behind the mirror, or another dimension of the mirror, is it's actually registering. Even though the red's gone, it registered the moment of red. So we're kind of maybe expanding the idea of the mirror here, but maybe we can do that. It's immediately just reflecting everything in the moment, but it's also storing, not as some like big giant bank account kind of story, but in some inconceivable non-material way, it's actually is registering every moment. And isn't it, it's just so mind-blowing, we might say, to think about how we can remember a detail of an experience from 20 years ago. And we all, without any effort, we all know how to, our minds naturally can do that. Isn't that like awesome that the mind can do that? And is it just this one simple mirror with lots of space, non-material space? Some would say it's the brain, right? It's the physical brain. All these little neurons are like, and some are stored over here and some are stored here. The Buddhist view doesn't really, they don't know so much about the physical brain. Okay, last question.
Our tradition, in Zen, it's no concern, makes wide use of painting. storyteller, whose dominant characteristic seems to be very little explicit. Thinking is very spare, the poetry is very open, the storyteller's story has no moral. But this seems to point to something that is experienced directly in that spaciousness. Am I understanding correctly if I were to say that I think that that's the fourth time?
I would say that the Zen intention of simple, direct aesthetics, I think is part of Zen gardens and painting and poetry. I think it's more like it's pointing us more towards like the first, the sensory direct valid cognition. Like we're just, it's kind of like de-emphasizing all the conceptual and coming more into the sensory world because it's more present and direct. It's not all, it's just, you know, this being the senses is not ultimately liberating, but it's helpful because especially in the modern world where we're so conceptual, that I think just to focus on direct, we look at a painting with a little black mountain in the mist and down in the corner here, and it's like a very sensory experience. I mean, art is all about sense, the sense field, the visual sense. And also shakuhachi music, if that's Zen music, very simple, plain sound of wind, no melody. I think these things are like to bring us into like the simplicity of the sensory world, to de-emphasize the conceptual aspect. I think it's very valuable because it's very present and direct valid cognition. And then the self-aware one would be like, it's so all-encompassing and all-inclusive that the reason I would say it like this is that I wouldn't say that happens more, you know, or better with Zen aesthetics than with other things. It's just like a mirror is completely equanimous with really complicated and really simple equally. So, and it's just, you know, non-stop, non-discriminating. But the sensory world is more like there are times when we're really focused on that and less focused on that. And we can cultivate it through like Zen arts. So, some thoughts about this kind of complicated Indian system as another version of mirror-like awareness. And, you know, as I've enjoyed studying this today, and I think I may continue. And, I mean, this is a topic we could easily have whole, you know, classes on, and it's hard to fit it into one talk. But, again, it's a framework for studying our experience moment to moment, seeing who we are in this world and our relationship to this world. May all beings settle into their ever-present, self-aware, direct, valid cognition where nothing's inside or outside, at ease. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.